here we are again. So how you doing, everyone? It's been a while, and I apologize for the delay between episodes. Today's show was actually meant to cover a different subject, but that episode is still in the works at the moment, primarily due to the sheer volume of research and legal consultations that have gone on around it. So it should be with you in a few days, though. So again, I really am sorry to keep you good folks waiting. So anyway, this week we saw the passing of Lorraine Warren, clairvoyant and paranormal investigator for over 50 years, alongside her husband Ed. The Warrens, if you hadn't heard of them, have investigated some of the most notable hauntings, possessions, cases of demonic infestations and poltergeist activity of the past half century. In fact, you may have heard of them and not realized it. Their exploits and investigations have spawned many a Hollywood movie, either directly inspired by their, dare say, adventures, or have been based on events that they were involved in. Examples being the Amityville Horror, The Haunted, A Haunting in Connecticut, the Conjuring franchise and its spin-off series Annabelle, and also the Poltergeist franchise to a certain extent. But who were the real Ed and Lorraine Warren? What did they actually investigate? And what were the true events surrounding their research? Tonight, together, we find out the truth. This is The Casebook of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Without any doubt, the most well-known and real-life Ghostbusters of the last 50 years were Ed and his wife Lorraine Warren. Together, they, with the aid of some assistance from the Catholic Church, tasked themselves with getting rid of spirits, demons, and poltergeists from the homes of families in distress from unwanted visitors. So let's start at the beginning. Ed Warren was born in 1926 in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he referred to himself as a religious demonologist. He was self-taught, of course. Raised Catholic in what he described as the rough-and-tumble part of Bridgeport, Ed lived in a what he described as a haunted house as a child. He witnessed ghost lights, heavy breathing, and the specter of an old woman. His common-sense policeman father always reminded him that there was a logical explanation for everything that occurred. But this never sat right with Ed. He would grow to become fascinated by the supernatural. Lorraine also grew up in Bridgeport. She began to experience psychic phenomena when she was 9 years old, first of all starting with the ability to see the auras of those around her, although she firstly kept this ability under control due to her devout Irish Catholic family. But in addition to this, she also knew nothing about hauntings, spirits, demons, or any other supernatural things until, that is, she met Ed. They married in 1945 while Ed was serving in the army. Then, at around 20 years of age, Lorraine stepped into the ocean-born Mary House in New Hampshire and experienced her first out-of-body experience. This shook her and her understanding of all she had experienced prior to this. We'll come back to the ocean-born Mary House in a moment. After the army, Ed briefly attended art school. Throughout the 1950s, he and Lorraine also roamed New England in a Chevrolet Daisy, searching for haunted houses for Ed to paint. This was a way for them to earn money and for Lorraine and him to gain experience in dealing with the paranormal. It's worth mentioning at this point that this was their only training in dealing with the paranormal, formally, of course. In the 1960s, the Warrens set up sort of a ghost investigation service of sorts. But they discovered, and or decided, that many haunted houses were infested by far more malign presences than just the spirits of the dead. When the Warrens were called in to investigate a case, the usual process would be the following. After getting some background from the complainants, which was usually a family, Lorraine would walk through the house to pinpoint the problem. Demons can be detected by the presence of a particular nauseating odour, the Warrens are quoted as saying. They preferred dark nooks and crannies, so the Warrens always cased out basements, crawl spaces, attics, and closets first. After giving the house the once-over, shall we say, they would turn on a regular tape recorder. It sometimes picked up unexplained noises, and the Warrens played these tapes for their demonology students and lecture audiences to prove that demons were in fact walking among us. They also displayed blurry photos that depicted white streaks that Lorraine explained were round globules of spirit energy invisible to the human eye, but not to cameras. Now, just to make it clear to you guys, I'm not saying at this point whether I believe in what the Warrens were doing was correct and legitimate, or whether it was slightly fraudulent. I'm just playing forward what I have found and investigated. These are facts. I will allow you guys to be the judge, although I would highly recommend reading The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle, which I use as a lot of the research material here. It's about Ed and Lorraine's history. But that said, In a Dark Place and Ghost Hunters are also two books written by Ed and Lorraine Warren themselves, and also great reads and give a brilliant insight into their world from their perspective also. All are available on Amazon right now. And just for your information, I am not endorsed by Amazon to say this in this episode. Anyway, the Warrens believe that people, not just homes or places, can be possessed by demons. Ed taught his students that demonic possession occurs in an orderly five-step process. The five-step process was encroachment / permission, infestation, oppression / obsession, and possession, which was the actual replacement of the human spirit by a demonic entity. If the process isn't interrupted by a knowledgeable and experienced demonologist or spiritual leader, he warned, suicide and or murder is the final possible and highly likely step. The Warrens would always determine which stage had been reached when investigating a demon-infested house. Depending on the severity of the haunting or demonic infestation, Ed would either perform a prayer session or call in assistance from the clergy. The Warrens then studied the phenomena closely and advised the complainants on what to do and what not to do. In the most extreme cases, an exorcist was summoned to perform a deliverance, which is sort of a exorcism light, which is popular with the evangelical Protestants and Christomatics alike. According to Ed, inhuman or demonic spirits are so unworthy of life they are prevented from taking on a physical form, but they can manipulate the physical environment in certain ways, which again can cause enormous damage and destruction, as you can imagine. They harbour immense eternal hate of both man and God, which is unparalleled by any known man, creature or beast. He taught that demonic manifestations often result from satanic rituals, curses, or occult activity. Part of Ed's investigative process was also to identify the occult entryway that the spirit had used to enter our reality. It could be something as innocuous as a Ouija board session conducted for fun by a single member of the household a decade earlier, for example, or something as dastardly as generational curses and pacts with the devil made by Satanists. To determine if something was at the third stage of infestation, bodily possession by a demon, the Warrens relied almost exclusively on eyewitness reports. Ed insisted that he always sought ordinary explanations for strange phenomena before he would even consider a supernatural explanation, but he rarely consulted doctors or psychologists to find out if mental and medical conditions were to blame for the client's unusual behavior. This would have disastrous consequences in several cases. In most cases, the people involved with the Warrens weren't harmed by having their houses blessed or by holding prayer vigils. However, over the years, the Warrens made a habit of aiding scammers, child molesters, and even murderers by offering supernatural excuses for their bad behavior, which soured their reputation amongst those in the know. They've blamed people not directly involved with their cases of creating supernatural havoc by practicing Satanism or placing curses on innocent people. They've been accused of exaggeration, sensationalism, exploitation, even outright fabrication. But equally of worth to note is that those who accuse them of fabrication of things of that ilk have done so equally without evidence or credence to their claims. So the truth is fairly murky around this subject. Let's take a look at some of their more famous cases. First of all, the Oceanbourne Mary House. According to Lorraine, this is where her psychic powers first manifested fully. Ed had painted the haunted house as a dreary and forbidding place, but Lorraine had no reservations about entering it. She didn't believe in ghosts at that time, and as soon as she stepped into the house, however, she experienced her first out-of-body experience and felt the overwhelming presence of despair. She soon discovered she was a clairvoyant and a trance medium due to this specific experience. From 1917 to 1965, this house was touted by owner Louis Ray as a haunted home containing hidden treasure. He gave it the name Oceanbourne Mary House after Mary Wallace, and he ran it as a sort of tourist attraction. His elderly mother would dress up in a shawl and bonnet and work at an old spinning wheel by the fire, while Ray rented out shovels so visitors could dig for gold in the backyard. As legend had it, Mary Wallace had been born at sea in 1720, en route from Ireland to America, on a ship named the Wolf, captained by her father, James Wilson. Somewhere in the Atlantic, the Wolf was raided by Spanish pirates under the command of a buccaneer named Don Pedro. Hearing the newborn baby's cry from below deck, Don Pedro demanded the baby be brought to him. He had intended to slaughter everyone on board, but when he saw the tiny infant cradled in her mother's arms, he softened. He ordered his men back to their vessel, allowing the Wolf to forge on to America. As a parting gift, he gave the captain's wife a length of beautiful green brocade silk. 24 years later, Mary wed her husband in a gown made from that silk. And around 1760, the pirate, Don Pedro, learned that the Irish baby that he had spared lived in New Hampshire, so he settled in the town of Henniker. He built a spacious house and invited the young widow with three sons to live in it. Mary Wallace agreed. Shortly after moving in, she saw Don Pedro and a swarthy stranger bearing a trunk in the backyard in the dead of the night. The old pirate refused to tell her what was inside it. One day, Mary came home to find the old pirate had been slain, run through with a cutlass, blood everywhere. She remained in the house until her death in 1814, amid rumors that a fortune in pirate treasure was concealed somewhere on the property. The real story, however, of the Oceanbourne Mary House isn't quite as interesting. From my research, I've been able to find that the house had actually been owned by one of Mary Wallace's sons, and she never actually lived there. She lived a mile away with another of her sons. There wasn't a pirate protector, there was no gold, but the legend and the tale spun by Louis Ray gained wide attention with the publication of Hans Holzer's book, Yankee Ghosts. And to this day, the Oceanbourne Mary House, though unremarkable in just about every respect, continues to draw curious tourists, treasure hunters, and ghost researchers. Whatever residual despair Lorraine Warren felt there didn't come from pirates or secretive widows. That's not to say, of course, that it couldn't have come from somewhere else. So to take us on to our next of the Warren's cases, one titled Satan's Rock. In August 1979, the New York and Connecticut State Police contracted the Warrens to help investigate the alleged satanic dealings of a prominent rock and roll singer that was living in the Ridgefield area. Ridgefield resides on the Connecticut and New York border, hence the involvement of both law enforcement. Residents had been reporting profane chants, gunshots, and bizarre music coming from the singer's property, and a policeman had allegedly been attacked by a caped and hooded mob. Poking around the singer's estate, the Warrens found the remains of a ritualistic bonfire, ceremonial stakes, and signs of animal sacrifice, so they stated. Later, this singer would introduce a new form of music called Satan Rock. The problem with this story is that Satanic Rock was around before 1979, and not one of its originators lived in or around Ridgefield. I could find no mention online when I researched Satan Rock of a specific musician who created it around that time. However, I came across a mention of Keith Richards in Maury Terry's book The Ultimate Evil. Richards lived in Connecticut around the time in question, and according to Terry, his then girlfriend Anita Pallenberg was practicing weird rituals in his mansion. A burned out area was found on the property, indicating ritual bonfires, but in my humble opinion, bonfires, loud parties, and a freaky girlfriend do not a Satanist make. But we'll continue, and continue on to one of the Warren's most famous cases, Amityville. This was the case that made the Warrens famous. You probably know the story. In November 1974, 23-year-old Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. killed his entire family with a rifle as they slept in their beds at home in the village of Amityville, New York. Butch DeFeo was a heroin junkie who was stealing money from the family's car dealership. He had never done an honest day's work in his life due to his privileged upbringing, but he seemed to think his family owed him a living. So he shot his parents, his two younger brothers, and his two younger sisters in the hopes of inheriting everything. It's still not known how he was able to shoot each family member without waking the others with a shotgun. All were found in their beds, laying face down. After murdering his family, Butch drove to the dealership and pretended nothing had happened. Late that night, after hanging out with friends, he discovered the bodies. Faced with evidence that one of his guns had been the murder weapon, he soon confessed. Though he pled insanity and did a passable impression of a lunatic in the witness stand. The jury, however, saw through DeFeo's manipulations and convicted him of second-degree murder. Over the years, Butch DeFeo has made many ludicrous allegations about the murders. In 1986, he declared his mother Louise was the real killer, and in the year 2000, he said his sister Dawn and her friends carried out the murders in front of him. Afterwards, he said he shot Dawn. At other times, DeFeo has openly admitted he murdered his family. And let's not forget, he also originally boasted that the devil had possessed him and made him commit the murders. Others have come forward with strange, highly suspect stories about what happened that night also. An anonymous man claiming to be a DEA agent told researcher Rick Moran that he had been surveilling the house when the murders occurred. He saw Dawn leave the house and drive away in one of the family cars. Gunpowder was allegedly found on Dawn's nightgown, as though she had fired a gun that night. There are some out there, actually many out there, that suspect that Dawn really was the killer, or at least conspired with her brother, only to be betrayed by him in the end. But, whatever happened, there is little doubt that the murders were Butch DeFeo's idea, and that his motive was financial. In December 1975, surveyor George Lutz moved into the DeFeo house at 112 Ocean Avenue, with his wife, Kathy, and his three stepchildren, ranging in ages from 5 to 9. In February of the following year, they held a few press conferences claiming to have spent just 1 month in their new home because they had been tormented by terrifying phenomena that included hundreds of flies materializing in a closed room, dismembered voices, and mysterious fluids leaking from walls and keyholes. Kathy claimed she saw a demonic pig floating outside a second floor window. George said he experienced bursts of rage that were very out of character while living in the house, and he descended into a deep depression. Both claimed that Kathy spontaneously levitated in her sleep one night, and that her face took on the appearance of an old hag for the next 6 hours. The youngest child, Missy, had conversations with a ghost. The priest, who blessed the house on the day they moved in, as Kathy was Catholic, heard a man's voice say, "Get out," while he was alone in a room, and his car mysteriously broke down that evening. The Lutzes consulted an eccentric paranormal researcher and self-confessed vampire hunter named Stephen Kaplan to investigate their house. Kaplan, who often referred to himself as a doctor despite his lack of a doctorate, didn't conduct an investigation, but inconsistencies in George Lutz's story led him to conclude the entire haunting was a hoax. Researcher Rick Moran researched the same conclusion. The Warrens, on the other hand, fully supported the Lutz's account. Lorraine said she could sense a demonic presence in the house from the moment she entered it, and suggested that Butch DeFeo had been possessed by an evil spirit at the time of the murders. This was consequently the alibi that he was trying to pass during his trial. As evidence of possession, she pointed to the time at which the murders began, 3 a.m. According to the Warrens, 3 a.m. is the witching hour, at which point people are most vulnerable to demonic attack. The Warrens concluded that the DeFeos were in a state of phantom mania when Butch shot them, which paralyzed them and prevented them from crying out for help. They attributed the hoax allegations to Stephen Kaplan's 20-year vendetta against them and seemed to delight in the fact that he died from a heart attack 1 week before his second book on the case, The Amityville Conspiracy, was published. Jay Anson's non-fiction book, The Amityville Horror, and the movies of the same name contain numerous exaggerated elements. Some of the exaggerated elements were that the house was not situated on a site where local Native Americans abandoned their insane and dying, and that there is no evidence for Hans Holtz's claim that an Indian chief was buried at the site. The priest who blessed the house, Father Pecorano, gave conflicting accounts of what he had experienced there. At first, he told researchers he didn't experience anything unusual at all, though in the published account, he was ordered to get out by a throaty, disembodied voice, and later he would later break out in boils. He would later admit that he did hear voices and experience some car trouble, but he didn't attribute these things to the supernatural. Subsequent owners found no evidence that the doors and windows had been damaged by mysterious gale force winds that came out of nowhere, as described by George Lutz. The Lutzes resided in the house for several months. That's fact, and not just one. Most damning of all, Butch DeFeo's defense attorney, William Weber, had commissioned Anson's book and met with the Lutzes to discuss its contents. He told People magazine in 1979 that he and George Lutz had concocted the whole story in the hopes of selling the rights to it. He hoped to gain an appeal for his client by presenting evidence that the house contained some force, natural or otherwise, that drove some of its inhabitants to insanity. He won the protracted legal battle that resulted from his collaboration with Anson and the Lutzes, but his client remains in prison to this day. Finally, in 2003, Kathleen Lutz's middle child, Christopher, declared the haunting was a hoax. He later partially retracted this accusation, saying that while some of the incidents were fabricated, the haunting really did occur. The Warrens in no way contributed to resolving the case, aside from bolstering William Weber's argument that his client was insane or under some mysterious influence. Rather than being criminally liable for the carefully orchestrated murder of his entire family, of course. And even in that regard, the Warrens were less than helpful. And as I mentioned, Butch DeFeo remains in prison to this day. Currently, Butch DeFeo denies that any external influence drove him to kill his parents and siblings. The Warrens were paid consultants' fees to the first Amityville movie and its sequel. George and Kathy Lutz insisted until their deaths in 2006 and 2004 respectively that the haunting was real. The next case is the Arne Johnson case. In February 1981, Arne Cheyenne Johnson of Connecticut was charged with murdering his girlfriend's employer. His attorneys presented the novel defense that while Arne physically committed the murder, he wasn't ultimately responsible for it because he had been possessed by some of the demons that plagued his girlfriend's little brother. Ed and Lorraine Warren had investigated this possession shortly after it began and concluded it was initiated by a devil of a very high order. So to be clear, the Warrens were defending a potential and now convicted murderer with zero evidence. The Johnsons came from the Warrens' hometown of Brookfield, Connecticut. In the summer of 1980, Mary Johnson, age 42, was a divorcee raising two daughters and a niece while working as a motel housekeeper and at the same time battling cancer. Her son, Arne, 18, had been the man since he dropped out of 10th grade to help support the family. He was planning to marry his girlfriend Debbie that autumn. Debbie was a dog groomer who had been renting a room in the Johnsons' home for 4 years, with her 7-year-old son from a brief teenage marriage. Arne was just 14 when they met. On July the 2nd, Arne and Debbie began moving the whole family into a rented country house in Newtown. The kids and their sheepdog, George, could romp safely in the yard. Arne, an aspiring to be tree surgeon, looked for landscaping work. Money would be tight, but Arne and Debbie seemed prepared for the challenge. Both were mature, hardworking, and responsible. Yet Debbie's parents, the Glatzels, thought it was a potentially disastrous move. A lot of time, money, and effort had to go into such a large family. The old ranch house that Arne and Debbie rented itself held a disturbing presence. George the dog began barking as soon as he reached the threshold, just as the Lutz's dog behaved strangely at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, FYI. Debbie felt a sudden chill in the stifling hot hallway, and moments later had an uncharacteristically angry outburst at Arne. Such outbursts were also reported by George Lutz, incidentally. Debbie's mother pronounced the house creepy, and not a happy home, complaining of odd feelings when she was in it. A storage room in the basement was locked. The owner's daughter explained that no one was allowed in there. Again, this secret room has a counterpart in the red room in the basement of the Amityville house, and such rooms will show up again and again in other cases investigated by the Warrens, notably the haunting in Connecticut. Debbie's three little brothers, ranging in age from 11 to 14, pitched in to clean up the house on that afternoon. 11-year-old David, a chubby and cheerful boy, was actually assaulted by the transparent apparition of an old man while he was alone in one of the bedrooms. The man shoved him backwards onto a waterbed left behind by the previous tenants. He pointed at David and said, "Beware," then faded into invisibility. David immediately fled the house and refused to re-enter it. A short time later, his brothers were momentarily trapped in the same bedroom after the door slammed shut by itself and refused to open. The Johnsons didn't stay in the house that night, but George was left there to guard it. David told everyone about the ghost man and made the unnerving claim that he could still see events occurring in the house from a distance. He said the man had sprouted horns and was chasing George, causing the dog to scratch frantically at the front door and the door to the locked room in the basement where the old man lived. David was also receiving telepathic orders from the ghost devil to remove all Catholic paraphernalia from the Glatzel home. Debbie was spooked enough by her brother's story to announce that she had changed her mind about moving the Johnsons into it. David next received a telepathic warning that no one was to tell Mrs. Johnson about the ghost. The boy announced, "Mary is his," he says. "He's been interfering in her affairs for a long time. He's going to break her down. He wants her to do his work." Then he made two predictions. The waterbed would burst by 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the next day, and Judy Glatzen, his mother, would be blinded by midnight if anyone told Mary Johnson that her home was already occupied by something. And if there's any more impertinence, there's going to be the unrelenting pandemonium. David was in special ed classes at school and had never used big words like these. The family didn't know what to think. They were certain the boy hadn't taken any drugs or watched any scary movies, and that mental illness or trickery apparently didn't cross their minds. As it turned out, George had scratched up the doors in the rental house. When the Johnsons returned to the Newtown house, they found the landlady had lied to them. Her daughter was still living on the property, and utilities would not be included in the rent as originally agreed. The daughter calmly informed Debbie that the man devil was merely the ghost of her granddad, a harmless old man. Despite this and David's warnings, Mary Johnson moved in immediately. But Ann and Debbie packed their stuff and moved in with the Glatzels. Mary was upset that her son and his fiancée had backed out of their arrangement, especially on such a flimsy and bizarre pretext. Because of this, Ann became estranged from his mum and sisters. At the Glatzel house, David was giving forth a new string of prophecies and warnings. Among other misfortunes, his own hand would be burned and he would also be stabbed. Then he announced hysterically that the ghost was coming to get him at that moment. He charted the spirit's progress as it floated over trees, houses and roads, finally landing in the next door neighbor's yard. Mrs. Glatzel ran to fetch her holy water, splashing it across every door and window in the house to bar the devil man's entrance. This repelled him for a little while, according to David. The spirit returned to the Johnson house. On July 14th, Debbie recorded in her journal, David was stabbed twice by an invisible knife wielded by an unknown invisible entity. A few hours later, he was shot in the stomach by an invisible gun loaded with invisible bullets. Since he wasn't injured in any way, the family merely doused him with holy water and recited the 23rd Psalm as recommended by their priest. Judy was blinded at 11:45 p.m. when her son accidentally poked his finger in her eye, scratching the cornea. David burned his hand at a 4th of July picnic, and the ghost that David now called the Beast finally penetrated the holy water-saturated Glatzel house via an attic window. David told his mother the Beast was molesting the Johnson girls and had ordered David to begin praying to him as his new father. The boy received slaps from an invisible hand for talking about these things. He said at night the Beast demanded David's soul, but David, being a good Catholic boy, held on to it. Amazingly, nearly everyone in the Glatzel family, four adults and four boys under 14, bought into David's weird stories, as did Debbie, and, to a slightly lesser degree, Anne. They began hearing thumps, scratches and footsteps from the attic. They swore that the beast threw David around the room, banged on walls and accused all other kinds of chaos in the household. They began sleeping in the living room out of fear. Only David's dad, Carl, didn't believe they were being haunted. He thought his son needed help. Carl Jr., 14, didn't believe any of it either. He became angry, foul-mouthed and confrontational, mocking everyone else for believing David's stories. At one point, he called his mother a bitch who deserved to be killed. He insisted the whole family had gone away and needed mental help rather than a priest. After The Devil in Connecticut was reissued in 2006, Carl Jr. filed a lawsuit against Brittle and the Warrens for defamation. Ed Warren had said of him, as quoted by Brittle, "Denial of the truth is the way of the devil," and young Carl's behavior was a classic illustration of that fact. Carl says the demonic possession of his brother was a hoax cooked up by the Warrens, and accused the Warrens and Brittle of invading the privacy with the publication of their book. In self-defense, Lorraine Warren declared the possession had been judged genuine by six priests, the cream of the Catholic Church, she said. When she arrived to collect her waterbed, which had indeed sprung a leak, the previous tenant of the Newtown house told Anne and Debbie of poltergeist activity in the house, including cold drafts and the clucking of ghostly chickens. For some reason, she believed the locked room held a profane altar used by witches. The Johnsons and Glatzels were all devout Christians. Mary had even spent 4 years in an Episcopalian convent prior to her marriage. She had reared all her children as Baptists, attending church and Sunday school every week. Sadly, this devotion had primed them to believe in some strange things, and they were all very concerned about the haunting. On July the 6th, a fellow dog groomer told Debbie about the Warrens, who had helped her friend deal with a ghost that she had. The following night, Debbie saw the beast crawling across the living room ceiling in the Glatzel home. The Warrens agreed to take the case. They would later call it the worst that they ever saw. They arrived with a Bridgeport physician, Dr. Anthony Giangrasso. Carl Sr. tried to dissuade them, however, from entering the house, saying his family had gone crazy. But Judy welcomed them with relief. Dr. Giangrasso examined David. David was the only member of the household who could hear and see the beast and the 43 demons, which he said had materialized from his balls of light in the bedroom. The beast claimed to be Satan and said it had no soul. It liked to sit in a rocking chair in the living room, while other entities flocked to the attic to bask in the heat. Incidentally, rocking chairs played a prominent role in the Amityville case and the story of the ocean-born Mary House, which is worth noting. When they entered, Lorraine could sense the beast's presence, and the fact that David could see and hear the beast from the very beginning indicated to them that it was an unusually powerful entity. They were alarmed by the speed with which the phenomena had progressed. Barely 2 weeks had elapsed since David's first encounter with the ghost. David, they concluded, was a victim of transient possession. The Warrens quickly pinpointed the cause, though it would be later replaced by a more sinister explanation. In the early 70s, Debbie had taken an elective high school course on witchcraft and the occult. Debbie had also once used a Ouija board, receiving messages from entities the Warrens identified as incubi and ghosts. Even though she had disposed of the board, the law of invitation left the entire extended family vulnerable to the entities that dwelt in Mary Johnson's rented house. Weirdly, the demon horde commuted between the Glatzel home and the Johnson house, but the latter manifestations were limited to strange noises heard by Mary's youngest girls, ages 9 and 12. Mary would later move her family out of the Newtown house because the girls were afraid to live in it. There were other factors too.
Carl Sr. had never been baptized. Carl Jr. was non-religious, and Debbie and Ann were living in sin.
For a couple of weeks, David's possession worsened. He became hateful and vulgar, pulled a knife on one of his brothers, showed an aversion to holy water, and tried to strangle Ann. The family summoned the Warrens. Dr. Gian Grasso or John Kenny Hertz, who was one of Ed's assistants, whenever he got out of control. Then, in the latter half of July, all was relatively quiet, until David and his brother Alan reported hearing strange noises. A girl calling out for help, a snake hissing, disembodied whispers. The Glatzel house, like the Amityville house, became thick with flies. Activity resumed full force when Father Dennis, the family priest, departed for a vacation in Ireland. Objects levitated and struck people. Apparitions appeared. A humming or vibration permeated the house. The beast returned to tell David that be death in the family, and no one would be able to help them. The physical attacks on David increased in frequency and violence. Judy kept him indoors at all times and watched him continuously. She also refused to be left alone with him. Fathers William Millier and Steve DiGiovanni, filling in for Father Dennis, were summoned to the house by Judy. They urged a superior, Father Grasso, to help the family. He was skeptical at first, until he witnessed David being levitated, strangled by an invisible force, and speaking in a strange, unknown voice. Meanwhile, Arne took matters into his own hands. As the demons demanded David's soul and threatened to kill someone, he splashed holy water in the directions indicated by David himself and commanded them all to be gone. Without realizing it, Arne was violating the essential precept that man can command such spirits only in the name of God, one of many sincere but tragic mistakes Arne would make in this case. Ann even begged the demons to leave David's body and possess him instead. Soon, Ann was able to see the beast as clearly as David saw it. David's possession continued to escalate. He spoke backwards and in tongues, and his body swelled to such enormous proportions that his skin cracked. On August the 5th, his head rotated 180 degrees. On August the 6th, he woke up from a nap to find he had undergone a physical transformation. Bloated, nose like a pig's snout, limbs limp, he spoke and laughed only in a throaty growl. Such dramatic and horrifying transformations are rarely reported in poltergeist cases, but they pop up again and again in the Warrens cases. Recalled that Kathleen Lutz saw a floating demon pig and took on the appearance of a hideous hog while sleeping. The Smurl haunting, which will be discussed later, included a demonic pig monster and also a physical transformation. The entity that possessed David's body attacked Alan and Ann, called Julie a stuttering harlot, and made sexual overtures to Judy and Debbie. David could merely point at the object and make it fly across the room. Despite continuous observation, David was able to get his hands on knives, fireplace pokers, and other dangerous items with which he tried to kill members of the family. Throughout this period, it was Anne who protected the family from assault. Certain her son was now fully possessed, Julie summoned the Warrens. Ed Warren told the family that if Anne hadn't been present, someone would surely have been killed. This statement will become important later. The family sought, and was denied, an official Catholic exorcism, but a Father Virulac agreed to perform a cleansing and perhaps an exorcism in the Glatzel home anyway. He had worked with the Warrens in 1972, exorcising a house on Hartford's Beelzebub Avenue. Later, the bishop gave the go-ahead for a deliverance, which was not a full exorcism, by the way. This would be performed in the chapel of St. Joseph's on September the 2nd. David had to be tied to a chair for transport to the church, where four priests performed the deliverance under the Warren supervision. At the ritual's conclusion, Lorraine announced that the lesser of the 43 demons had been successfully expelled,
leaving only gluttony, lust, and a demon named Gaitois, and one murderous devil that raged, spit, and blasphemed. Overall, in other words, the deliverance was unsuccessful.
Just worth mentioning here, there isn't actually a Beelzebub Avenue in Hartford, but there is a Beelzebub Road in South Windsor, which is in Hartford County. Also, I would suggest caution while googling Gaitois, unless you're looking for a sale on butt plugs. Just FYI.
Ed Warren later described seeing a devil during David's deliverance. The room grew cold and a dark form materialized, he said. Normally, the features of the entity are not discernible, but I saw a face. It changed from human to inhuman to satanic to snake-like to lizard. I never want to see anything like that again. The following Sunday, Arne cursed loudly and blacked out in the middle of the church service. He said he had seen a black entity standing at the altar, mimicking all the priest's movements. Later that week, David predicted someone would be stabbed to death and Arne would end up in prison. He then rattled off a string of unfamiliar names that would turn out to belong to judges, lawyers, and court officials involved in the murder trial of Arne Johnson. None of these names are given, however. A psychiatric examination of David found no mental abnormalities, and family therapy was recommended. This angered Julie Glatzel and the Warrens. How dare qualified professionals suggest that people who were afraid to be alone in their own homes with their demon-infested children might be in need of professional help? On September the 8th, a second deliverance was conducted on David in a convent. Again, the boy broke out of his restraints and had to be held down on the floor by the priests. At one point, he stopped breathing for over a minute, yet no one thought to summon medical help. This would be a good time to point out that there have been many fatal exorcisms performed on women and children in the past several decades. Exorcists, professional and amateur, have strangled, starved, suffocated, and beaten people to death in their efforts to roust demons. As you may have guessed, this second deliverance too was only partially successful. Ed complained bitterly that this was because the church had refused to allow the ancient rite of exorcism, the Ritual Romanum, and without it, the demons couldn't be banished fully. Judy shared this view. "The church abandoned us," she said. She claimed that a monk had visited them in a chauffeur-driven limo just to tell them that demons didn't exist. The family's troubles were not at an end. The Warrens believed there was still potential for danger in the Glatzel/Johnson household as late as October 1980 and broke their confidentiality agreement with the family to warn local police. Their fears were not unfounded. Carl Jr. allegedly stabbed his brother Alan, beat his mother, and harassed and tormented Arne by destroying his belongings. Police were called to the house up to two times per week until the incidents died down in November. Also in November, Debbie and Arne moved into a nearby apartment so that Debbie could manage a kennel for her new boss, who was 39-year-old Alan Bono. Having delayed their wedding, she and Arne now plan to marry in the spring of 81. Other than experiencing a few fleeting possessions that transformed his features into a demonic visage, Arne was a perfectly normal guy. On Sunday, February the 5th, Arne and Debbie picked up his little sisters at Mary's house for an overnight stay at the kennels. The following day, Arne felt fluish. He called in sick to work. At around 11 a.m, Alan Bono invited the whole family out for burgers. He was already drunk, being, which was according to Debbie, an alcoholic. Alan drank wine throughout lunch, then continued to drink wine throughout the afternoon and evening while Debbie and the girls groomed the dogs. Arne took a nap. They all planned to go to the Glatzels' house for dinner at 6. Debbie later said that she had felt uneasy throughout the day for no obvious reason, and Judy claimed she could feel tragedy closing in on the family. She phoned her daughter that evening with pleas to come over as soon as possible, before anything bad could happen. Around 5, Alan Bono asked Arne if he could fix a stereo speaker in his office. Then he implored Debbie and Arne to have dinner with him. Debbie relented. She ordered pizzas rather than eating, Alan became belligerent, banging on his TV set, playing loud music. Debbie decided to go to her parents' house after all, but Alan refused to let the three Johnson girls leave his apartment. At this point, Arn experienced one of his transitionary demonic possessions. Without provocation, he knocked Debbie to the floor and began kicking her viciously in the stomach and head. Alan and Arn soon got into a fight in the yard. Suddenly, Alan collapsed to the ground. He had been stabbed 4 or 5 times by a knife that Debbie and the girls claimed they hadn't seen until they found it on the ground nearby. It was covered in blood. By that time, Arn had left the yard. He was found wandering on the side of a road in a daze. Charged with murder, Arn Johnson claimed to have no memory of the evening's events and insisted he would never have killed his friend unless, you guessed it, he was possessed by demons. And the Warrens backed him up with this story. There was no intent or premeditation for Arn Johnson's part in any harm to anyone. His body was simply seized and used as an instrument to kill. The Warrens' take on the story was that essentially, because Debbie dabbled in the occult as a teenager, she left her family susceptible to demonic attack. And years later, her little brother David wandered into a house owned by a witch and encountered a powerful demon which summoned dozens more demons to possess the boy. By challenging the demons without invoking God, Arn inadvertently left himself open to possession. Then, 6 months later, the demons made him go to batshit insane and stab his landlord to death. A likelier story is the somewhat religious, heavily superstitious Glatzel and Johnson families interpreted the theatrics of David as an actual demonic possession, and the story became more elaborate and more dramatic after the Warrens got involved. Months later, Arn Johnson was beating the hell out of his girlfriend in front of his sisters and his landlord. Alan Bono tried to intervene, and Arn stabbed him to death. Afterwards, Debbie and the Johnson girls wanted to keep Arn out of jail, so they crafted a story about him being possessed by the same demons that supposedly exited David months earlier and painted the victim as a belligerent drunk. A priest from Quebec, Father Deschamps, later examined David Glatzel. He informed the family that David's possession stemmed not from his sister's academic interest in the occult, but from a satanic curse placed upon Carl Jr. and David by a family they joined every year in Old Forge, New York for a snowmobiling vacation. These people were practicing Satanists who had pledged the souls of the two boys to the devil in exchange for some unknown benefit. This was why the Glatzels suffered misfortunes like broken bones and sciatica after every trip. Judy and Carl Sr. confirmed that this middle-aged married couple with two kids had a house full of occult paraphernalia, such as black velvet furniture, chalices and daggers, not to mention an altar and even a skull. Hence, by the end of this awful story, every iota of blame has been removed from the Johnsons and the Glatzels. According to the Warrens and Father Deschamps, there was nothing they could have done to prevent the crazed, violent behavior of David or Arn's murder of Alan Bono. In October 1981, Father Deschamps performed a charismatic deliverance on David inside an old stone church in Quebec City. At the conclusion of the ritual, the spirit identified itself as Beelzebub. David didn't speak throughout the deliverance. His voice was projected from the mouth of one of the priests instead. Also in October, Arn went on trial for murder. His demonic possession defense, the first in US criminal history, was quickly squashed, thanks to Judge Robert Callahan's ruling that David Glatzel's behavior was not relevant to Arn Johnson's state of mind. Arn refused to accept a plea bargain for the lesser charge of manslaughter, and was convicted of manslaughter anyway, and was sentenced to between 10 and 20 years in prison. His lawyers declined to appeal the decision, and he was released in 2001. The Warrens continued to defend Arn Johnson, and they would go on to defend several other criminals whom they declared weren't really responsible for their own actions due to possession by devils, demons, ghosts, and werewolves, until their deaths, most recently Lorraine's. A Haunting in Connecticut. The haunting of a Connecticut funeral parlor that was turned into an apartment building was featured on the Discovery Channel series A Haunting in 2002, and is also the basis of the recent horror movie The Haunting in Connecticut. The Discovery documentary should be the more factual of the two retellings, but as we'll see, the story isn't as straightforward as Lorraine Warren or celebrity psychic Chip Coffey would like us to believe. In A Haunting, the family is called the Parkers. Mother, Karen Parker, does some of the narration but does not appear in the actual show. The recreations feature actors 14-year-old Paul Parker, who was diagnosed with cancer and was given 6 months to live despite aggressive treatment. And the long trips to hospital were wearing of the family, so they made the difficult decision to move closer to the hospital. With four kids, Karen had a hard time finding a place to rent in the area. She finally found a fine old house with hardwood floors, two bedrooms plus a basement that could serve as a bedroom for two of the kids. It seemed out of the Parker's price range, but it wasn't. As it turned out, the house had a secret. Mortuary equipment was still in the basement, including a bone saw, freezer, and jars of embalming fluid. Karen didn't want her sick child living in a former funeral home, so most of the equipment was removed before the Parkers started moving in. They didn't tell Paul about the house's past. The first terrifying thing happened almost immediately. As Karen mopped the kitchen floor, the water turned blood red, and this was for no apparent reason. Paul was creeped out in the basement. He felt cold chills there and felt he was being watched. In other parts of the house, he heard creaking footsteps, heavy breathing, a voice calling his name, and other strange sounds. Karen began to fear that because her son was close to death, he could sense that the house had been a funeral home. She and Ed took Paul to their priest for a healing. Despite his fear of the house, Paul liked to play in the old morgue room, which, in this version of the story, still contained a steel gurney. One day he took his younger brother Bobby into the room, told him to lay on the gurney, then spun it around in circles until the boy became dizzy and frightened. The boy's little sister Connie saw a ghostly woman in her bedroom. Karen assumed the boys had told her about the funeral home and scolded them. They denied it, however. A short time later, the boys also saw a shadowy figure walking around the basement. They decided to sleep in the living room. Bobby was reluctant to go into the basement after that. When Karen insisted he go down there, he could hear a voice calling Paul's name. Karen, who didn't believe in ghosts, teased and chided the kids for their behavior. Ed Parker finally told the kids they were living in a former funeral home, but insisted it was not, could not, and definitely was not haunted. They were growing concerned about Paul's mental health. Karen wondered if Paul's medication could be causing hallucinations. Paul's doctor assured her it couldn't. One morning, Karen set the dining room table for breakfast before returning to the kitchen. When she did return to the dining room, the table was completely bare. All the dishes mysteriously returned to their cupboards. She tried to ignore the incident. Paul and Bobby, forced to sleep in the basement, continued to see apparitions there. Now they were so well defined that both boys could clearly identify them as four men, talking amongst themselves. The men picked up objects, read papers, and went about their business as if they were still very much a part of the living world. To calm his sons, Ed Parker checked all the windows and doors for signs of entry. Everything was locked tight. This sort of thing happened nightly. Ed and Karen grew exasperated. The boys, frustrated that their parents didn't accept the reality of the ghosts, slept with the lights on and discussed their experiences with each other. "That's where we got our strength from," a shadowed Bobby Parker says, "because no one believed us." Paul stopped talking to his parents about the things he experienced, becoming more reserved and quiet. He set up his own bedroom in the basement, wore dark clothing, took little joy in anything, wrote dark and disturbing poetry. Nothing unusual, particularly for a boy who had been through a devastating illness, however. The family was under great financial strain at this time, due to Paul's medical bills and high electrical bills. To ensure the boys wouldn't continue to sleep with their lights on, Ed removed all but one light bulb from the basement. One night, Bobby woke to see one of the bulb's lights flickering on and off. His sister Connie was standing at the top of the steps, flicking the light switch on and off. When he chased her upstairs, however, she vanished. Karen told him Connie had been upstairs asleep in her own bedroom for hours. That winter, Paul's cancer went into remission, and a 13-year-old cousin, Teresa, came to stay with the family while her parents went through a divorce. Paul began to confront his fears. When he heard voices whispering his name from the morgue room, he entered it and faced the apparition of a bearded man in an old-fashioned suit. Teresa noticed the changes in Paul. He was angry, mean, hateful, and seeing things. He complained to Teresa that a demon had come into his bedside every night and told him to say bad things to his parents and siblings. Paul was unable to resist. The man had total control over him. Eventually, he wasn't even able to move when the man came into the room. The man threatened to harm him if he didn't do as he was told. Teresa decided to tell Karen about the visitations. She was now fearful of her cousin. So was Bobby. Teresa slept with rosary beads for comfort. One night, Ed and Karen heard struggling in the room where Teresa slept and entered to find Paul grappling with her on the bed. He was trying to sexually assault her. Ed pulled him off and subdued him with difficulty. The family called an ambulance for Paul. He screamed and struggled as paramedics led him out of the house. At the hospital, he told his parents, "Now that I'm out of the house, they'll be after you." Karen feared that her son would never be mentally well again. Early that morning, before dawn, Ed left for work, exhausted. Karen descended into the basement and sat at the bottom step, gazing around, hoping to see some of the same things that Paul had seen, so she could be reassured that her older son wasn't actually disturbed. She saw nothing. She went upstairs to take a shower. She became tangled in the shower curtain and was convinced that an unseen force had wrapped her up in it. At almost exactly the same time, Teresa felt the covers of her bed being pulled away from her by invisible hands and heard her aunt's muffled cries for help. Teresa ran to the bathroom and disentangled Karen from the shower curtain of death. Both of them were now certain that the house was haunted. Teresa sobbed in fear. Downstairs, the kitchen phone rang, and Karen answered it. She heard only the eerie giggling of a child. Both women felt and saw a darkness, a black-like smoke descending over them like a thousand hands. Teresa cried during this part of the story, re-experiencing the terror and helplessness she felt at that moment. Teresa and Karen actually saw the form of a man develop in the smoke that crept across the dining room ceiling. The rosary on Teresa's neck levitated into the air. Meanwhile at work, Ed watched his truck start up by itself and cross the parking lot of its own volition. It slammed through the wall of the small outbuilding in which he was standing. He phoned Karen, who was by now hysterical, to tell her what had happened. They agreed to ask their priest for help immediately. Bobby, who was asleep in the living room, was awakened by Paul calling his name, asking for his help. Karen alerted their priest as to what had been happening. He advised her to forget about it, acknowledging the evil presence would only give it more power. Karen had recently read about the Warrens in the newspaper, so she turned to them for help. After hearing the family's stories, Lorraine did a usual walkthrough of the house. She felt drawn to the basement, where she sensed a horrible infestation, a non-human presence. The Parkers needed an official Catholic exorcism, the Warrens declared. They recommended the entire family stay together in the house, even sleep together in the living room for safety, as the Glatzels and Johnsons had done. The Warrens would stay with them. John Zaffis, Ed Warren's nephew and another demonologist and investigator who was working with the Warrens, declared this was the worst demonic infestation he had ever witnessed. He experienced cold spells, which means a lot of energy is being drawn, he said. Michael Cuneo, author of American Exorcism, appeared on A Haunting to explain that people who request exorcisms typically believe in such infestations of houses, rooms, or individuals. The Catholic clergy is trained to take a more skeptical stance. Exorcism can be a very effective therapy, at least in the short term, Cuneo says, because people have a strong expectation that it will work. It can be like a supernatural placebo. Karen felt crushing guilt for initially disbelieving Paul's stories. According to the narrator of A Haunting, this guilt made her very vulnerable to the entity in the house. She suddenly collapsed in the living room, overwhelmed by every negative emotion. Her neck swelled up. She experienced an out-of-body sensation. Prayers by the family and the Warrens eventually brought her around, after she had been out of body for more than 8 hours. That night, Karen saw the mattresses on which the family slept breathing. Zaphas felt a sudden drop in temperature and descended alone into the basement. He saw the bearded man at the foot of the stairs. Before his eyes, the man morphed into a demon, then a fireball that roared up the steps, blasting Zaphas backwards into a burst of heat and smoke. A priest, referred to as Father Frank on the show, arrived to determine if an exorcism was needed. After listening to Karen and the investigators, he approved an exorcism and assigned a Father Richard to perform it. This is not how official Catholic exorcisms work, however. Approval from a bishop is required. Father Richard experienced poltergeist activity in the basement, which was witnessed by Karen. His shirt seemed to pull away from his body momentarily, as though being plucked by an invisible finger. Later, upstairs, books and figurines flew off shelves of their own accord. A strange fluid leaked from a statuette of the Virgin Mary. Karen was thrown against the wall, levitated, then dropped to the floor. Teresa was levitated and choked. But at the conclusion of the exorcism, the house suddenly felt warm and comfortable. The investigation and exorcism had lasted 9 weeks in total. The Parkers moved out of the house a short time later, for fear the entity could return. Paul was released from hospital in the spring of that year. The real haunting. The case of the Parkers, whose real names were the Snedeker family, as related by psychic Chip Coffey in his essay Demons from the Dark, is not quite as dramatic as the events portrayed in A Haunting. Alan and Carmen, as the matriarch and patriarch were actually called, rented the house in Southington, Connecticut in 1986, shortly after it was converted from the Hallahan Funeral Home. They soon encountered multiple entities described by Carmen. One of the demons was very thin, with high cheekbones, long black hair and pitch black eyes. Another had white hair and eyes, wore a pinstripe tuxedo, and his feet were constantly in motion. The family often smelled foul odors. According to Carmen, they learned that one of the men who worked in the funeral home was guilty of necrophilia, so perhaps his heinous actions stirred up the demonic forces. The most disturbing poem written by her son Philip actually involved necrophilia. Philip wasn't aware of the history of the Hallahan funeral home. Zaphas saw an apparition and heard the sound of flapping wings. Coffey makes no mention of a fireball that blasted him off his feet, however. Carmen, Zaphas, and Coffey plan to release a book about the case in conjunction with the movie. According to a March 23rd story on Yahoo Movie News, the house's current owner is a Susan Trotter Smith. She has experienced nothing unpleasant aside from curiosity seekers invading the neighborhood. She loves the house, but hates the attention the haunting has brought to it. It's been a total change from a very quiet house in a very quiet neighborhood to looking out the window and seeing cars stopping all the time. It's been very, very stressful and sometimes worrisome. Police have been forced to attend, and extra patrols have been added to the area thanks to the trespassing. Neighbor Catherine Altimus states, "It's disgraceful. None of the haunting took place, and now it's ruining the lives of that wonderful young family that lives there." Lorraine Warren, however, is quoted as saying, "In the master bedroom, there was a trap door where the coffins were brought up, and during the night you would hear the chain hoist, as if a coffin were being brought up. but when Ed went to check, there was nobody down there. In 1991, a writer was commissioned to write a book about the case. The author of the book, which was called In a Dark Place, was Ray Garton. He's now a writer of horror fiction, incidentally. He wanted to publish the Snedeker story as fiction, but because of his agent at the time and a contract he was bound by, the story was labelled a true story, against his wishes. According to Mr. Gordon, elements of Carmen Snedeker's story clashed with elements of Al Snedeker's story, and it seemed everyone was having a problem keeping their stories straight. Frankly, I didn't notice until I had nearly finished all of my interviews and began going over the notes. Then I started having trouble matching up the details, he said. Gordon also said that Ed Warren told him to just make it up and make it scary when he approached the Warrens with his concerns over the inconsistencies. They told him they had videotapes of some of the activity in the house, but never produced them because they had been lost. He told Damned Connecticut, "Since writing the book, I've learned a lot that leaves no doubt in my mind about the fraudulence of the Warrens and the Snedekers. Not that I had much doubt anyway, but I've talked to other writers who've been hired to write books for the Warrens, always horror writers like myself, and their experiences with the Warrens have been almost identical to my own." He said the Snedekers did know the house was a former funeral home prior to moving into it. Gordon would also say that he had a niggling suspicion that Philip might not have actually had cancer. The Snedekers were vague about what kind of cancer it was. Carmen now identifies it as Hodgkin's, FYI. And people who knew them at the time told Gordon they weren't aware that the boy had been sick at all. He did have drug problems and mental problems, though. Personally, I have no solid evidence that the boy did not have cancer, and as I've never said that he didn't. But the evidence that he did is pretty flimsy, and when you combine that with the other holes in this story and some of the disreputable details about the Snedekers and the Warrens, it's difficult not to question it, Gordon says. A skeptic, Joe Nickel, investigated the Snedeker case back in 1993. According to his report, which was called Demons in Connecticut, Alan and Carmen Snedeker moved into the Hallahan house in June 30, 1986, with Carmen's two sons from a previous marriage who were aged 13 and 11, and their own two children, a 6-year-old girl and a 3-year-old son. Two nieces would also move into the house. The house had, indeed, once been the Hallahan funeral home, and relics remained, such as coffin handles, a blood drainage system, and a coffin hoist pulley. The behaviour of the oldest boy, Philip, was far more disturbing than the Warrens and Snedekers have let on. He was using drugs, vandalising property, and molesting both of his cousins. He was picked up by police, not an ambulance, after being caught doing this. He confessed that he had tried to rape his 12-year-old cousin. Rather than being in hospital, he was sent to a juvenile detention center. He once broke into a neighbor's house with the intention of stealing a shotgun. He told Carmen he wanted to shoot Alan with it. The Snedekers chalked this up to erratic behavior and cobalt treatments that Philip was receiving at the time. Later, Philip's behavior was extensively sanitized to make him look like a normal boy, preyed upon by evil supernatural forces. In reality, he was diagnosed as schizophrenic. Carmen and Al allegedly suffered sexual attacks from an unseen entity, but this part of the story didn't emerge until after the Warrens came onto the case. This is also what happened in the Smurl case. The Warrens had already made a book deal before their investigation was complete, allegedly promising the Snedekers a third of any profits. That book was Gordon's In a Dark Place. It was released around Halloween 1992. The Snedekers appeared on Sally Jesse Raphael, The Maury Povich Show, and A Current Affair to promote the book. Kathy Altamus told Nickel that most of the events attributed to ghosts were probably caused by mundane neighborhood events. For instance, she claimed that around the time Lorraine Warren heard chains rattling in the basement, a rattling truck was driving down the street. Nickel concluded that after other mysterious events that had occurred at the time of the alleged haunting, such as a power outage caused by a fallen tree and other such events, all had ordinary explanations. Though a haunting claimed that the family voluntarily moved out a short time after the exorcism in 1988, the landlady said they had been served an eviction notice for failure to pay the rent. Both the landlady and the upstairs neighbour had witnessed nothing out of the ordinary and suspected the Warrens and the Snedekers were perpetrating a profit-driven hoax. Gorton has disowned his book, and he explained the family involved, which was going through some serious problems like alcoholism and drug addiction, could not keep their story straight, and I became very frustrated. It's hard writing a non-fiction book when all the people involved are telling you different, fiction-like stories. FYI, the house was built in 1916. The house was the Hallahan Funeral Home from 1936 until shortly before the Snedekers moved in. Far from shielding the family from outside intrusion that might have made their situation worse, the Warrens immediately publicised their case. The first story about it appeared in the Bristol Press in August 11, 1988, under the headline, Southington Family Spooked by House. The Catholic Church has declined to confirm or deny that an exorcism actually occurred. In 1988, after the exorcism supposedly took place, the family priest told A Current Affair that no exorcism had been scheduled. There is no recorded evidence of a necrophiliac ever working for the Hallahan Funeral Home, at least not one that was actually caught. The Snedekers themselves experienced a string of tragedies during the time that they lived in the house. In addition to Philip's cancer, mental illness and criminal activity, Carmen's father died in 1987 suffering a heart attack during a home invasion that was never solved. Her sister was diagnosed with AIDS, her brother died in an auto accident. Gorton was initially excited about writing a book about the case as he found the Warrens entertaining, but instead of finding a haunting and a terrorized family, he found a rather dysfunctional one. Carmen was allegedly running an illegal interstate lottery business. Philip admitted in a phone interview that he stopped hearing voices and seeing strange things after he went on psych meds. When Gorton approached Ed Warren with his concerns about the family's conflicting accounts, Ed told him, "Everybody who comes to us is crazy. Otherwise, why would they even come to us? You've got some of the story. Just use what works and make the rest up and make it scary. You write scary books, right? Well, that's why we hired you. So just make it up and make it scary." Carmen eventually divorced Alan Snedeker and is now known as Carmen Reed. She claims that she has been psychically gifted since childhood, but suppressed that ability at the time that she lived in Southington. That's why she initially disbelieved her son's stories about ghosts. Her first supernatural attack occurred not in the late 80s in the Hallahan house, but in another rented house in a different city in 1980. She has a spirit guide named Jaco, and like Lorraine Warren, is a consultant to others experiencing hauntings. Once again, the Warrens took a highly suspicious haunting and turned it into a profitable tale of supernatural evil and terror. So did the makers of the 2009 film The Haunting in Connecticut, which deviates even more dramatically from the original story by turning the fictional Undertaker ghost into a sinister spiritualist who conducted seances in the basement, when he wasn't horribly mutilating the bodies of his clients, of course. In the movie, the character based loosely on Philip Snedeker is called Matt, and he dramatically relives the seances that occurred in the house many decades before his family moved into it. The movie includes CGI, ectoplasm, doors that operate by themselves, and a pastor who wants the family to get out of the house immediately. There is no mention of criminal activity, such as molestation, robbery, etc., though Father Peter has a drinking problem and Matt lashes out violently on one occasion. Gold Circle Films is reportedly planning two sequels to A Haunting in Connecticut based on other installments of A Haunting. The next case I've posted recently about on our Instagram page. It's to do with the Raggedy Ann doll. The Warrens actually highlighted this case on their website and it was featured in Gerald Brittle's book The Demonologist. More than any other case in their careers, this one indicates that the Warrens were not dealing with the full deck of cards. It reads like a script treatment for Bride of Chucky, and has now actually been developed into several movies. In the 70s, two young nurses named Donna and Angie turned to the Warrens for help. A large, raggedy Ann doll given to Donna by her mother was changing position and moving around their apartment of its own volition when they weren't looking. Then, childishly scrawled notes with the unsettling messages, "Help us" and "Help Lou," who was their roommate, began to appear around the apartment. A medium told the nurses that the spirit of a little girl named Annabelle had entered the doll. She had died in their apartment when she was just 7 years old and was desperate for human playmates. So rather than burning the thing or laughing themselves into a coma, the woman started calling the doll Annabelle and treating it like a real child. Lou, on the other hand, was convinced Annabelle was a voodoo doll that was taking advantage of Angie and Donna. He had nightmares of the doll crawling up his leg to strangle him, and on one occasion, a deep claw mark mysteriously appeared on his chest. The doll only moved when Angie and Donna weren't around, but there's no mention of where Lou was during these times. Both women insisted there were no signs of entry by an intruder. Ed Warren immediately concurred with Lou, the doll was possessed, but not by some sweet little dead girl. The nurses had inadvertently welcomed a demonic entity into their home. It caught their attention by teleporting the doll around, which made them acknowledge the presence of a spirit, which was their first mistake. Then they consulted a medium to find out more about the supposed ghost, which was their second mistake. Ed immediately summoned an Episcopal priest, Father Cook, who performed a blessing on the apartment. Rather than burn Annabelle, Ed and Lorraine decided to take the doll home with them, but Ed decided it was safer to avoid travelling on the interstate in case the entity had not been separated from the rag doll. His hunch was correct, and in no time at all, Ed and Lorraine would find themselves in the middle of vicious hatred. Then, at each dangerous curve in the road, their new car began to stall, causing the power steering and brakes to fail. Repeatedly, the car verged on collision. Of the incident, it was written in the Demonologist. The third time the car stalled along the road, Ed reached into his black bag and took out a vial and threw a sprinkling of holy water on the rag doll, making the sign of the cross over it. The disturbance in the car stopped immediately, allowing the Warrens to reach home safely. In Ed's office, the doll repeatedly levitated before his eyes. Lorraine heard growling sounds throughout the house. She warned an exorcist named Jason Banford to be careful driving home after he casually picked up Annabelle and said, "You're just a doll." Sure enough, his brakes failed that day. The doll is now safely encased in a glass cabinet in the Warren Occult Museum behind a warning sign, "Positively, do not open." The museum also houses a haunted organ, a cursed string of pearls, a vampire's coffin, and a portrait painted by the ghost of a witch. The price of admission to the museum is $35 a head and is located in Monroe, Connecticut, should you wish to pay a visit, of course. Now, there are many more cases in the Warren's files, and it would take hours upon hours to discuss each of them, but these are some of the most famous. I'll let you make up your minds as to whether you believe them or not. So polarizing are opinions of the Warrens. Thank you all for listening tonight, and please accept my apologies again for our gap in episodes. But rest assured, we are back to regular programming. Until next time, take care of yourselves, everyone, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.